Still there. Oh, say, does that star-spangled banner yet wave? The land of the free and the home of the brave. All right, please be seated. Continue on your course of action. Welcome to the Savage Nation. The British got what they deserved because they appeased the Muslim terrorists. Instead of reaching out to the Muslim community with force, they reached out with a supine begging demeanor. Tony Blair wanted to convene a commission on why the terrorists of 2 weeks ago struck and why the Muslim youth feel disenfranchised. A big fat Muslim cleric who's been living on welfare there for 19 years spit in their face yesterday. I saw it on CNN. This fat slob said, "You got what you deserve. We're going to do it again. And you can't stop us. And I'm going to take your welfare. Take it away from me if you can." They did nothing to him. They got what they deserved because they've been pacified, feminized, homosexualized, homogenized, Europeanized. They have lost their Britain. They've lost their Britain because of liberalism, which is a mental disorder. I am a total genius. I know exactly what's crippled the West. I don't need anybody to approve what I know is to be true. Liberalism is a mental disorder. The question is, can we save ourselves before it is too late? New York City today, the great mayor says that they're going to check bags on New York City subways. Sounds good, right? They're going to select people at random who are walking with bags. But listen to this. Here's the punchline. Here's the punchline. There will be no racial profiling. 85-year-old Chinese women in wheelchairs will be stopped, along with swarthy Middle Easterners in full Middle Eastern garb. You will not win the war with this kind of insanity. And today we're going to give the government a little advice, because when the government refuses to lead the people, the people must lead the government. Did you hear what I just said? The government is incapable of leading the people. The people must lead the government. They refused to close the border with Mexico. Today, Homeland Security rejected the idea of training civilian patrols on the border. They shafted the Minutemen.
Get off your Goebbels Nazi bandwagon. This propaganda is unbelievable. Talking about how the Islams over there are claiming that their youth are disenfranchised and Blair has concern for it. Blair has concern for people of Mideastern or Islamic faith? Is that why those bombs are dropping daily over in Iraq right now? You talk about liberalism as a mental disorder, which it is. But what's Boy George's excuse? What's O'Reilly's excuse? What's Karl Rove's excuse? Considering the fact that obviously he's a little Osama bin Laden jihadist collaborator because he's helping point out and expose CIA agents for the U.S. Empire. So he must be on their team. Well, at the end of the day, you're all on the same team. Because people who believe in capitalism, that's the new disorder. That's where the slaves come in. Check this out. You're listening to 103.3, 101.1, the Skidmark in Santa Cruz, 106.7, Illinois, 107.5, North Carolina, LUBER.com, the world, and RadioBrawl.net, the universe. And click in to the slave web. Just go to the Google web and go Slave Revolt Radio. Find out what time it is. Tonight, we're going to explore what the fathers who are supposed to have found this nation, what their position was on the separation of church and state, since there's so much hocus-pocusism being thrown around. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 103.3. Yeah, that's right, Slave Revolt.
Seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
You see, where they've gone, they're playing with the universe. They're playing with the solar system. But they have no perception and no way to measure what the amount of energy that's going to flow out from that light off is going to do to the rest of the planets in the solar system.
To a Beyond the Shadow segment. You know, a noted radical author, Lenny Brenner, who's written books like Zionism in the Age of the Dictatorship, has a new book out. And he talks about this book, and it deals with Jefferson and Madison on the separation of church and state. He was on the Infidel Guy show. It's an internet show. It's infidelguy.com. It's kind of an atheist free thought type program. They deal with, Islamic myth, Christianic myth, Hebronic myth, etc., etc. They have debates and what have you on their particular program and various people to interview concerning invisible kingdoms. So tonight, though, we're going to deal with an interview the Infidel Guy did with Lenny Brenner concerning his book. And we're going to explore this issue from the lens of what's going on now and throughout the world by the Christians, Islams, Hebrons, sorcerers, and how religion is used by the state for corporate control. Now, of course, many of us slaves know about, Jefferson and Madison, concerning their role and position on slavery. And we've dealt with those topics, like in my commentary, Happy 4th of July. It is a lie because it ain't our Independence Day. And we'll be dealing with other type subjects, down the road concerning these founders. But tonight we wanted to explore some of the aspects dealing with this whole separation of church and state. So, first off, let's hear from Brenner as he outlines some of his research that he's gone into concerning this particular matter. So check it out.
Was I went through everything that I could find by Jefferson and James Madison on religion and separation of church and state. And when I say everything, a lot of the material that they wrote on religion is in letters that they wrote. They were not public documents, okay?
Okay.
So you have to go through a million volumes of their work. Jefferson wrote 19,000 letters. Now, most of them had nothing to do with religion. But, you know, a couple of hundred of them do talk about religious subjects of one sort or another, you know?
Okay.
So what I did was I basically put together their works. I'm not the hero of Jefferson and Madison on separation, church, and state. I'm just the editor, you know? I sign the books because I'm alive and they're dead, you know?
Right, but, gotcha.
But they're the heroes. And what I did was I ran the two of them chronologically, and I ran them together. In other words, sometimes you get a letter from Jefferson to Madison, and other times from Madison to Jefferson. Sometimes Jefferson is talking to somebody else, not to Madison, and Madison is talking to somebody else, not Jefferson, but they're talking about religion, you know. And they work together from 1776. Madison met Jefferson for the first time after Jefferson had written the Declaration of Independence, and they worked together for 50 years until Jefferson died in 1826, okay?
Okay.
So basically what I did was I figured, hey, with Bush running up and down and jumping up and down about religion and faith-based initiatives and so on and so forth, I thought it was a good idea for once in the lifetime of the average American that they should know what they're talking about, all right?
Mm.
Namely that they, you know, whatever you think of religion, Madison is the author of the Bill of Rights. So what he thought about separation of church and state really is like the bottom line definition of church and state, all right?
And, okay.
And again, you have to put them together as a tandem team, a sort of, you know, sort of like the way people put together, let's say, Marx and Engels or Mutt and Jeff, for example. You know, I mean, in other words, they, Bud Abbott, Lou Costello, if you please, because they worked together for 50 years. And Jefferson was the American ambassador to France while the Constitution was actually being written. So Madison was the guy who got the reputation as the father of the Constitution because he was the one that basically managed the Constitutional Convention. I mean, you know, he was the spark plug that showed up every day and, you know, plugged away until they got all the compromises and so on and established Constitution. And then when Jefferson got a hold of the copy of the Constitution, he felt, hey, there's one thing wrong with it. It doesn't have a Bill of Rights. So he wrote off to Madison and said it needs a Bill of Rights. And Madison's attitude was, well, the problem with Bills of Rights is that they're parchment walls, that people go right through them. You know, if a majority wants to violate the rights of a minority, no Bill of Rights is going to help them, you know.
Interesting.
But, yeah, no, that was his initial attitude.
So you can see how Brenner is approaching this and a lot of the research he did to go into this whole particular matter and how seriously he took it. So he goes over everything he could find and so on and so forth and how long Jefferson and Madison worked together from 1776 to 1826. So, you know, a 50-year span in their particular collaboration with them both emphasizing the particular issues that they were most passionate about. So from that aspect, let's now hear what Brenner has to say as he outlines what Jefferson did actually to his own personal Bible. So check this out.
He says, look, I mean, all you got to do is look in any one of the colonies, and you see what happens when a majority wants to move. It just goes right through its Bill of Rights. So, but then he realized, hey, listen, Tom wants it, and a lot of the opponents of the Constitution want it. So if I give it to them, then they'll go for the rest of the Constitution. So, well, you know, I mean, it's only a parchment wall, but, you know, it's okay. If that'll bring unity, that's fine. But once he became in favor of it, he took it very seriously. I mean, in other words, these were guys who, you know, once, you know, they were before something, then against it. But once they made up their minds, one way or the other, they made up their minds and they really believed it. These are not, our kind of career ambitious politicians. So let's put it that way, you know?
Okay. So, yeah, you can see where they were coming from politically as far as the Bill of Rights and the particular Constitution. Now they Brenner goes into the Bible aspect of what Jefferson did. So check this out.
What the public didn't know was, like, let me give you an example of something, that in February 1804, President Tom Jefferson, who's the author of the Declaration of Independence, took a razor to his Bible, particularly to the four Gospels, and cut out every bit of supernaturalism in the four Gospels, okay?
Uh-huh.
All right, now, problem with that was that, and they pasted them all, you know, what he kept, he pasted, you know, like a manuscript. Now, that got lost right after he died. That was a common thing in those days for documents, especially private documents, to get lost.
Okay.
However, in 1819, he's in retirement, he decided, and he still had that original document that got lost, this, you know, cut out, pasted up version of the Gospels. He decided he wasn't satisfied with it, you know, because he did it after work while he was president of the United States. It's hot, dirty, sweaty work, you know what I mean?
Right.
So he didn't really give it the attention it really needed, so he did it again, only when he did it this time, he did it with a Greek Bible, a Latin Bible, a French Bible, and the King James Version of the Bible.
Wait a minute, I mean, did he speak all these languages?
Oh, yeah. I mean, let me put it this way. Most of his old age, he probably read more Greek than he read English.
Wow.
Yeah. I can't say he could speak it, because who could he speak it to? You know, he's living by himself.
Right, but he obviously could read enough to know where to cut things out at, right? So.
Oh, I mean, his Greek is. He's a great Greek scholar. I mean, a major Greek scholar. And one of the things that I had to do was translate about 20 things out of Greek and then more things out of Latin and so on and so forth. And Madison could read and write Greek and Latin. He could also read and write Hebrew.
No
Jefferson
way.
Couldn't do that, but Madison could.
Didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, let me put it this way. These guys were among the minuscule number of Americans of their day and age who were educated, but
right.
They really were educated to the best that America could do in their day. I mean, Jefferson went to William and Mary down in Virginia, which had some amazing good teachers, and Madison went to what is now Princeton University. Okay. So these guys are thoroughly educated. Now,
wow.
the second version where he cut up the Gospels, we have that, and that's in the book. It's called, everybody calls it now the Jefferson Bible.
Okay.
And what he did was he cut out all the supernaturalism. In other words, Jesus is born in a manger, but there's nothing about an angel appearing to the shepherds and the three wise men coming and, you know, following the stars and, you know, none of that kind of supernatural stuff. And then finally, he's crucified and he's buried in the tombstone, and that's the end. No rising from the dead.
So could you imagine and a president doing this nowadays? What would happen? I mean, they wouldn't even be considered, because the climate has, even though we're in 2005, is deteriorated so much into a form of faith-based mysticism, and that's tied into quote-unquote someone's morality, whether they are a moral or sound just person. These are all, of course, sound bites, because these demons are running around plunging the world into various chaos. And you see this not only within this particular decadent society, but you know, all throughout the world, the Sudan, so on and so forth. Those clowns, those sorcerers over there, are deeply steeped into their little hocus pocus mysticism, and base the code and morality of the society on a superficial level off of their little Invisible Man book. Meanwhile, they're committing genocide. But since they hold these particular doctrines as a guiding light and a principle, they somehow, in a gumpified down society, are able to get away with presenting themselves as being some kind of decent creatures. In essence, what's in part going on is that you have a world population that's so beat down and so confused and belittled that they actually are looking at their particular forms of Invisible Man belief as political, cultural, operational forces of combat against various entities throughout the world. But here Brenner outlines what the author of the Declaration of Independence describes as the artificial system. Basically, he did this in a rejection in a letter to a cat named Short. So check this out.
And he describes what he calls the artificial systems that he rejects. Now, I'm reading him now. This is Jefferson, okay? Artificial systems. Example, the Immaculate Conception of Jesus, his deification, the creation of the world by him, his miraculous powers, his resurrection and visible ascension, his corporal presence in the Eucharist, the Trinity, original sin, atonement, regeneration, election, orders of hierarchy and company, invented by ultra-Christian sects, unauthorized by a single word ever uttered by him. All right? Mm-hmm. Now that's him talking about all the things that he rejects, the author of the Declaration of Independence rejected in traditional Christianity. All right? And then, listen to this. This is another letter that he wrote, again, also to William Short, in April 13th, 1820. And he's talking about a syllabus that he put together about Jesus, meaning this Jesus, the Jefferson Bible. And he says, but while this syllabus is meant to place the character of Jesus in its true and high light as no imposter himself but a great reformer of the Hebrew code of religion, it is not to be understood that I am with him in all his doctrines. I am a materialist. He takes the side of spiritualism. He preaches the efficacy of repentance towards forgiveness of sin. I require a counterpoise of good works to redeem it in company. And it is the innocence of his character, the purity and sublimity of his moral precepts, the eloquence of his inculcations, the beauty of his apologues in which he conveys them,
right,
that I so much admire, sometimes indeed needing indulgence to Eastern hyperbole. Now, in other words, he's saying, hey, I disagree with Jesus on a very important point. I'm a materialist, and he meant that. He believed that any kind of notion of a spiritual God wouldn't work, that only material things affect material things. In other words, he lived in a material world just like you and me, and there was no such thing as a spiritual God.
Right,
he believed in a God, but he believed in a God, you know, literally a material God, like you, me, and a garbage truck are material.
Like an advanced super alien or something like that.
Well, you know, let me put it this way. It's almost as if, you know, on the ceiling of Vatican,
right.
You know, Michelangelo has the finger of God, you know, touching man, you know, Adam and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
He literally believed in some kind of physical God like that. Okay?
Wow.
Because,
okay.
Now understand. See, he's very clear about one thing.
Okay.
Namely, morality does not start with religion. He was ambassador to France, okay?
Okay.
And he met atheists there, and he knew of atheists like Diderot and de Holbach, et cetera, guys there who were famous for their atheism and their high morality. So his attitude was, you know, I am for freedom of religion. You can be an atheist. I can believe in God. It doesn't matter. Okay? It doesn't
right.
matter. But what you got to believe in is science. You know, he was an educated, man. Now, this is so far, this mentality is so far from Bush's mentality, it's not to be taken seriously.
So once again, see, this gives you an indication of the serious state that things are in. When you have cats in the 1700s being rational on certain degrees about how they materially view the world, and now things have been Orwellian flipped on its head to the point where you have... these clowns who mix in morality with religion, and they're actually able to get away with that at the same time that they're running around committing Abu Ghraib. They're running around torturing people within their own country, and then sending them off to other countries to be tortured. They're experimenting on little kids younger than 5 years old with non-approved drugs that terminate your DNA replication, basically at the behest of corporations. There's something seriously wrong and warped out when you have a society that will accept these types of people's so-called moral code and honor when they rip and lie, vacillate, manipulate, distort, and destroy, all basically in the name of the state. And you can see why the state apparatus wants to blend in religion so they can hide the true actions and the true meaning of morality. If you're plunging the earth into chaos, if you're destroying the ocean, if you're destroying the water supply, the air supply, the rivers, creating dead zones in like the Mississippi River, 7,500 feet long dead zone, because of the whole toxic petroleum-based type of society that these industrialists insist on staying in, then that right there should be a call to question of their morality. But if they can get you transfixed into the hocus-pocus world about what Jesus said, what Muhammad said, what is scribbled in the Quran, and all this type of archaic nonsense, then they basically have you where they want you. Now, here you have Jefferson outlining that morality, in his opinion, does not start with religion. Now, of course, nowadays, all of these politicians and, you know, other charlatans throughout the country and world cloak themselves in these religions and try to portray people who I think outside of those boundaries as being some kind of heathens and stuff. So once again, you can see how there is a situation where the ruling elite, they actually drive themselves on a very pragmatic, scientific way when it serves their interests. It's a dogmatic scientific way. In other words, it's based on their appropriation of resources for their financial domination and benefit. So the scientific development that they're into is for exploiting weapons technology, so on and so forth. They don't get mystical about that. In other words, they don't allow some sorcerer to wave his hand over a crude bomb and think that that's going to do the job. They do all the type of research that's necessary because they're serious about their particular domination. But that same type of scientific inquiry, they don't want people, the masses of people, to take within them on their daily lives. And you see it pushed out constantly by those people within the state. So here you have Bush pushing out faith-based programs. In other words, not rational, scientific-based programs led by people who are going to do serious scientific observation about the type of lead, mercury that's in people's system, what's actually causing it, so on. No, let the witch doctors take care of it. The Islams over in, you know, places like the Sudan are trying to push through Sharia law, you know, the INF, Islamic National Front. You can see how these types of regimes use state religion as a dividing wedge, as an identity type of stuff. You're not getting your just due in any of these particular societies. You could bow your little head down to whatever invisible, you know, man and whatever invisible kingdom you want. But all throughout the world, I see a common thing. The masses of Christians throughout the world ain't doing all that well economically. You know, a whole lot of them aren't doing that well physically. They're not doing that well emotionally. Islam throughout the world, not doing that well physically, emotionally, economically. There's turmoil and chaos all over the Hebrons, etc., etc. But when you look at these particular popes and what do they call them? Imams and priests and, you know, these other sorcerers, you see them fat and happy. And the reason is that, in part, there's a hierarchical structure. They're tied in with the particular states within their societies, and they all live quite well as being accomplices with the state. And sometimes they're thoroughly a part of the state apparatus. They, in that hierarchical structure, are doing quite well. Because at the end of the day, whatever hocus-pocus belief you believe in, on the ground, we're talking about man-made, human-made structures. All these churches, synagogues, mosques, they're all built by human beings. It's human beings that build these things. It's human beings that set up the structure of who has particular authority because of their particular position and association with you know, the tooth fairy or whatever. And within that, and within those states, there is economic benefits, advantages, and positions of power and influence throughout the state. Now Brenner outlines some of Madison's positions on church and state, and the veto measure that he passed through in 1811 while he was president. So check this out.
Let me just give you a little Madison. Madison doesn't get into anti-clericalism in the way that Jefferson does. I mean, he doesn't list all the things in Christianity, in traditional Christianity, that he thinks are nonsense and stuff like that. He doesn't get into that at all. He's very concerned mainly about the separation of church and state. That's his thing, okay? Now,
okay.
In 1811, on February 21st, 1811, he wrote a veto. He's president of the United States, and he vetoed a bill, all right? And the bill is called an act incorporating the Protestant Episcopal Church in the town of Alexander in the District of Columbia. And he vetoes the bill. Now, he gives several reasons why he vetoes it, and most of it is non-controversial. In other words, neither me nor Pat Robertson would argue with him on it. The bill incorporated a Protestant church, including its rules, its internal rules. You know, in other words, basically, the act of incorporating it would say there has to be a priest, and the priest has to do this and that, and so on and so on. So that's plainly not the business of the government of the United States. And no one would try to, you know, argue with the thing. But he ends his veto with one paragraph, which you could apply word for word to Bush's faith-based initiatives. Let's say a drug clinic run by a church, you know, getting government money. Let's say something like that, all right?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Now, just listen to this with that kind of thing in mind, and you'll see how this veto measure applies directly to it. He says, quote, because the bill vests in the said incorporated church an authority to provide for the support of the poor and the education of poor children of the same, an authority which, being altogether superfluous if the provision is to be the result of pious charity, would be a precedent for giving to religious societies as such a legal agency in carrying into effect a public and civic duty. Okay, now that's what he says. Now, basically what he's saying is, hey, if Church A over there wants to run a drug addicts clinic on its own,
right,
that's terrific. Go for it. But it can't be doing what we, the government of the United States, should be doing in our name.
Mm.
You see what I'm saying? I mean, you know, because he does not want to sound like the government of the United States has any connection. It's not sanctioning a church, and the church isn't sanctioning the government.
That makes so much sense, right? Because it's inevitable that if we... The churches should actually see the benefits of there being a separation, and as you know, some do. That just makes so much sense because, right, if they allow the government to come in and start regulating things, it's not going to stop just there.
Okay, here, like, let me give an example of something. Now, this didn't get into the major newspapers, but it got picked up by Christian Century, which is an excellent magazine put out by, you know, very educated Christians who deal a lot with the politics and sociology of religion.
Right.
I mean, I disagree with their religion, but not their sociology. You know, they're really very scholarly. I can't praise them enough. What they're talking about, they talked about how Kerry went out during the election to Indianapolis to a convention of the African Methodist Episcopal Church,
right,
and he said that he also was in favor of faith-based initiatives, but he wanted to appoint a commission to make sure that it was all done constitutionally, and the commission would include on it, let's say, some religious figures, plus, let's say, some experts on how to administer drugs to the poor, you know, and some politicians.
Right.
Well, the problem with that is, unless you're going to have a commission with 7 million people on it, or 294 million people on it, he's going to pick some religious leaders. In other words, he would have been president of the United States, and the president of the United States would have picked a Catholic, a Protestant, a, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But he wouldn't pick, let's say, Louis Farrakhan for that commission.
Exactly.
All right. In other words, basically, the president of the United States would be deciding which are the important religions and which are the unimportant ones, and which are the ones that would be worthy of being on a government commission to decide how to integrate religion and government.
And this is exactly what was warned before this even happened. And what, Lenny, now? This is exactly what we're seeing, aren't we?
All right. So, but what I'm trying to get at is that what these politicians are doing flies directly in the face of these guys. Now,
so once again, you see how Madison, what Madison was writing, and his position on church and state and the separation and the veto measure that he threw out in 1811 is in such contradiction to what these hooligans are up to today, and why he put through those types of measures in veto in the past. Here you have a situation where we can see how the right is doing it through money influence to the black church to basically, you know, pimp out these little ministers who are being leveraged over as little hoes to back policies of the right because of economic political influence that they can get by appeasing to them. So when the state gets involved in this type of stuff and is sanctioned, like Kerry himself also said that he wanted, through this, it's an art of coercion. You decide what particular groups, as Brenner was mentioning, get accepted for what program, so on and so forth. And of course, these Weasley politicians are going to make sure that the ones that they select adhere to many of the policies that they want politically. Now, being that they're politicians, they, of course, are under the influence of their own particular masters. And their masters, of course, are part of the corporate state apparatus. So you see how it all becomes intertwined and manipulated. And since in a hocus-pocus society and world that we have, where these sorcerers have undue influence, you can see why the corporate state would want these politicians of theirs to use whatever type of financial economic influence to impose itself on these particular preachers and imams and so on and so forth, and use the financial benefits that the state apparatus can gather for these guys to direct them in particular ways. Now, we've seen this play itself out in history of America, where we have a situation where, you know, recently the Baptist Church in the South apologized for its role of slavery in America. Now, why would they do that? Well, in part, what they were apologizing about was that they used that the Southern Baptists in their conventions developed this kind of philosophy where they justified the slave trade in the South, and they played a pivotal role in the whole Civil War and the split that happened between the South and the North, and how the South viewed itself as being ordained by God, as being the really ones who were following under their doctrines of the Gospels. And we've seen these things play itself out in other ways. The whole concept of manifest destiny, where it became a thing where it was people's destiny in the America landscape to push out west, i.e. over Indian territory, and take over even more Indian territory, which basically meant destroying the native population and liquidating their means of survival, the buffalo, etc., etc. But it took on a religious tone. Now, of course, the state, they just wanted the land. The capitalists wanted the land. They wanted that. They wanted the resources because this would help their economic power be in a stronger, larger state capitalist enterprise. But they were able to cloak it in these religious terms that, you know, had this Moses-like appeal to the masses of people who, in the name of this sorcery, ended up playing an extermination role on the native population. Once again, the state was looking at it from a material standpoint, but they used hocus-pocusism to indoctrinate much of the population to carry out the deeds, where at the end of the day, they're the ones who materially benefit. Now, next, Brenner outlines more of James Madison's memorandum. So let's check out this aspect of the detached memorandum. Check it out.
Take it a step further. One of the most important documents in my book is a thing called the Detached Memorandum by James Madison. Now, what happened with this memorandum, it has a history. He wrote it sometime between 1817 and 1832 after he retired as President of the United States. He took over, Jefferson was President, then Madison succeeded him, and then Madison retired and he wrote this thing. Now, when he died, when Madison died, his papers were given to a friend of his, a historian named Rives, to put together, by the government, to put together a definitive edition of Madison's works. I mean, you know, they were honoring him and so on. Well, the problem was that this thing called a detached memorandum got stuck in a pile of Rives' private papers rather than Madison's papers, all right?
Okay.
And it stayed buried away until 1946. Understand, Madison died in 1836.
Wow.
So it was lost for 110 years. It was only found because a woman historian, Elizabeth Fleet, was doing a biography of Rives, the historian.
Right.
Okay, so she found it, and of course she ran down to William and Mary, which is one of the most important specialty, you know, universities when it comes to the founding fathers, and they printed this thing, and it's been cited by the UN, so there's no doubt about its reality. I mean, you know, it's for real, but it has a curious history. It didn't make an impact when it should have, let us say, if it had been published, let's say, before the Civil War or something like that, you know, and it got lost for, you know, as I say, until 1946. Now, but listen to this. This is by the guy, James Madison, who is the author of the Bill of Rights, the author of the First Amendment, nothing less than that. And he asks, is the appointment of chaplains to the two houses of Congress consistent with the Constitution and the pure principle of religious freedom? And then he answers his own question. In strictness, the answer on both questions must be in the negative. The Constitution of the U.S. forbids everything like an establishment of a national religion. The law appointing chaplains establishes a religious worship for the national representatives to be performed by ministers of religion elected by a majority of them, and these are to be paid out of the national taxes. Does not this involve the principle of a national establishment applicable to a provision for a religious worship of the constituents as well as of the representative body approved by the majority and conducted by the ministers of religion paid by the entire nation? All right?
Summarize. That was pretty wordy. Summarize that for us.
In other words, he's saying that in strictness, chaplains in the House of Representatives and the Senate are unconstitutional.
Okay.
All right? Because they violate separation, church, and state. But then he goes further. Listen to this. Better also disarm in the same way the precedence of chaplainships for the Army and the Navy than erect them into a political authority in matters of religion. In other words, he was against having paid preachers in the military. In other words, his attitude was, hey, if a bunch of guys on the ship are Christian, you know, Protestant Christians, they can pick one of their own guys and he can do all the ministering, you know. But the government of the United States should not be appointing him a minister. All right? Now, this is a guy who wrote the Bill of Rights, okay? So when you're talking about what it means and what it should mean, now understand there's always a certain amount of slack, you know, in what the Constitution means. Like, for example, most people don't know it, but separation of church and state originally was only on the federal level, not on the state level, because some of the states had their own official church in 1787 and 1789 when the Bill of Rights was passed, all right? Massachusetts had an official church until 1833. So they weren't going to give it up to go into the new United States. So the Bill of Rights, the freedom of religion, separation of church and state, only applied at the state, at the federal level. All right. Okay. It's only in modern times that the Supreme Court says it applies everywhere in the United States. All right. So there's a certain amount of slack. But let's put it this way: if you're a judge and you want to know what the Bill of Rights means or any part of the Constitution, the first thing you want to know is what did the Founding Fathers actually say about this. See what I'm saying? Because that establishes it. It defines what it meant to them.
So once again, we see a situation where Madison, the cat who wrote the Bill of Rights, was outlining how there should be no appointment of chaplains and all of that stuff in the House of Representatives, in the Senate, the Army, the Navy, etc. Now think how, you know, you see Ashcroft and all of these clowns using this sorcery and how it's manipulated in the Army and stuff, and how they have their little chaplains. Now, Madison didn't care if a couple of guys wanted to get together and you know, do their little talking and whatever about whatever invisible man. But for the state to appoint a particular individual paid by the government, et cetera, et cetera, he saw that, as the writer of the Bill of Rights, as grossly crossing the line. And this is something that he had written between 1817 and 1832. Now, recently there was a flack, well, it was a little while ago, about the Chinese cat who was in Islam. And, of course, you know, Bush and them detained him and did some stuff. And we're saying, you know, questioning whether he was putting out a particular message, you know, while he was serving as a Muslim chaplain to the Muslim cats. What's interesting is that one of the first things that should have been said and questioned was, what are any of these cats doing having the authority of the state and being allowed to have these services at taxpayers' expense, through taxpayers' expense, to these people in the little military and stuff? If they want to get together and do their little thing, you know, well, I'm so sorry for you, but do your thing. But once you give it the authority and sanctioning of a particular society, especially one as barbaric as this, then you can see how things become off hinges, and how Madison and them saw this as a violation of the principles of church and state. But next, let's go into how Brenner outlines some of the issues going on with religion in America. So check this out.
I've got a passion.
It's called peace.
Shut it's called peace.
What Bush is doing is he's appealing to the most religious elements in America. Now understand, what you got in America is a huge spectrum. A majority of Americans believe in God. About 64% believe in God with no wavering. They believe there is a God and that's the end of the matter. That's 2 out of 3. Another 16% have doubts sometimes. You know, they believe in God, but sometimes they doubt. Okay? And then about 14% don't believe in a religion, but only about 2.5% define themselves as atheists. The rest, about 8% believe there's some kind of superpower in the world. Not a god, exactly. It's hard to define, if you know what I mean. You know, that kind of vagueness and so on. But the fact of the matter is, what's even more important is that millions of Americans are either changing their religion or changing their religious denomination. In other words, like millions of Americans have left the Catholic Church, for example. Millions. Okay? Right. I mean, it's one of the most important social transformations in modern history.
Right.
Millions of Americans, of educated college kids, have left the upper class Protestant religions, Episcopalianism, Presbyterianism, etc. They become atheists in college. Or, you know, they cease to believe in religion in college. 27% of all kids who are born Jews in the United States are atheists today. A majority of the Jews in the United States reject any kind of Jewish religion, any kind. They have nothing to do with any Jewish religion whatsoever. It's up and down the scale. When it comes to education. But even, like, the biggest Protestant denomination in the United States is the Southern Baptist Convention. They've had 4 straight years of a drop in new baptisms. All right? So what you've got is, you've got a majority of people still believing in the hardcore religion, but they're feeling themselves losing the battle. In other words, their kid goes off to college and the kid doesn't join the church.
Right.
That kind of thing, you know? They turn on the TV and, you know, at certain hours you have to watch. You can't let your kid turn on the TV because there's a porno show, and over there is a majority of Americans today believe that premarital sex is okay.
Wow.
Okay? First time in American history, about 2 years ago, they decided that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, so what's happening is that the people that don't believe premarital sex is okay, they hear George Bush and they go, oh, yeah, man, he's our kind of guy. I mean, he's talking that old-fashioned religion.
Yep.
And they don't care what religion he's talking about. As long as he's talking religion, it vibrates with them. Like, he wound up getting 70% of the vote of the Orthodox Jews in the United States.
So once again, we can see some of the stuff that has taken place. When you have 64% of the American population believe in the invisible tooth fairy, and without wavering at all, and 16% believe in it, but waver and have some doubt at times, then you can get an idea of the dynamic that's taking place. But at the same time, you have a portion of the population that is becoming more and more connected with the particular religions that they happen to be in. So in other words, they still believe in some kind of deity. They still believe in Santa Claus, but they don't believe in the various houses of Santa Claus. So these various institutions are becoming worried. So they are pushing back. And from that concept, you can see where the struggle and a push to continue to try to gumpify the population can take place in the classrooms, like the issues of evolution versus creationism. You know, in other words, science versus faith-based hocus-pocusism, because they see it crucial that they, within their particular religious branches, maintain a growing number as opposed to a depleting number. And they see trouble taking place with the fact that people have to deal with the material world because of the realities that people live. If you were dumb enough to have some kind of faith-based belief in Boy George because you believed that since he's some kind of spiritual, right, individual, that he would not be so cynical as to guide the country into an unjust war, and you partly base that in because of him being a Christian individual, well, of course, you're easily manipulated. But at the same time, now, as this war is dragged on, as the Downing Street memos have exposed, as the cynical action of Karl Rove has helped expose, the material reality has come crushing down on you. And this is how you see the polls drop, even though they were artificially inflated off of a faith-based type of pretense of believing in an individual because of their so-called moral high ground, even though at the same time this is the death penalty president and with the death penalty governor. But the state apparatus and the church does not want these types of realities to settle within people's bones. So they want to keep pushing out a particular dogma generation after generation. So this helps see the dynamic and the crusading aspect and how the minions like O'Reilly will be on board pushing through, you know, gay scout leaders and how this is going to bring down the morality of the scouts and all of that. In other words, they have their particular crusaders pushing this poison out to get you off track, that it may be your sons or daughter or you dying in Iraq because of a false prophet named Boy George hypnotizing you in part through his moral high ground and nationalism and stuff, and what this country is supposed to represent, you know, which mixed in with many Christian means something on a justified plane as opposed to an imperial plane where it really rests beyond rests on. So you can see this dynamic taking place, and this is why in part you continuously see these imperial crusaders push out fairy taleism to the masses within the school system and push the morality, quote unquote, thing. When I say morality, I'm talking about bourgeois morality, you know, how you deal with your sexuality, how many partners you have, etc., etc. Not imperialist lack of morality, you know, destroying the ozone, destroying human beings with depleted uranium, stuff like that. Those aren't really topics that are issues you're supposed to analyze on a moral ground outlined by the state and their minions. But next, let's deal with how Brenner outlines how no matter which party won in 2004, no change concerning separation of church and state was going to be taking place. So dig this.
Understand, both parties live off the rich. I mean, you know, they get their money from the rich to hustle the poor.
Mm.
Okay?
Yeah.
I mean, George Soros spent $28 million trying to help Kerry.
Right.
Okay? I mean, so it's not just Bush when it comes to the money. But basically what I tried to do with this book is it hit me that no matter who was going to win the election, the question of the relationship between church and state wasn't going to go away. I mean, we obviously, this is a country where a majority of people still has some kind of religion, and, you know, they don't know anything about what the government is and isn't supposed to do. I mean, it's so bad. 52% of the American people don't know that the Bill of Rights is another name for the first 10 amendments. I mean, you know, in other words, that's an elementary thing. If they probably, in most cases, what it was they looked at it, the Constitution in junior high school.
Right.
You know, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
They don't even have, I mean, I don't have a poll right in front of me, but I'd be surprised if the majority of Americans have a copy of the Constitution in their house.
Right.
Okay? So what you got is a million and one Americans out there vote for candidates, come along and tickle them under the chin. Right? Because the politicians now do polls and they know everybody who's out there. Alright? They can find out what your mail is like. Alright, so they can tell you're a white duck hunter from Kentucky. Okay?
Right.
And the chances are you got such and such religion because you live in such and such a neighborhood. So
that's
they'll
right.
send you an email. They'll send you a letter aimed at white duck hunters.
That's right.
Okay? And so basically what it is that their attitude is, well, you got X number of Christians, Y idiots, Y number of Jewish imbeciles, Z number of atheist fools.
Right.
Okay? Because, and I say atheist fools. I'm an atheist, but I've met any number of atheist fools in my day.
Yeah, I hear you.
Well, you know, I mean,
yeah.
I think of all those people who went out and voted for Kerry when Kerry was telling, all those atheists who went out and voted for Kerry when Kerry was saying to the African Methodist Episcopals that he was in favor of faith-based initiatives like Bush.
Yeah, I voted for him myself, and I sometimes wonder, did he just say that to get votes? And I sometimes wonder, as a politician, would I have done that? I mean, it's hard to say, because I know plenty of people who are undercover atheists in Congress. I've had wives of people contact me and congratulate me about my show and what I'm doing, and they say they have to remain undercover. So they will say things and vote for things, even when they don't agree with them, because they're trying to get in a position in which they can truly make a difference. So I didn't really take them too seriously on that myself, and that's why.
Well, let me put it this way. If number one, we're bound in a very peculiar way. When we talk about separation of church and state in the United States, we are literally bound legally by the Constitution and Supreme Court decisions coming from it.
Right.
Okay? So you can't, if you take separation of church and state seriously, you can't vote for a candidate who you know is going to violate, is going to take an oath to uphold separation of church and state, and then is going to violate it.
All right, so once again, we hear how we have a situation where, as Brenner said, both parties live off the rich. But in a society where the church is mixed in with the state intentionally, and you have a majority population believing in that this kind of invisible kingdom apparatus, that how easy it is to manipulate people on real issues. When you have a situation where most American citizens and most American people in general have no constitution. Now, these are the majority of the people in this society say they believe in this society. They believe in the government. They believe in the founding fathers. The majority of them don't have a constitution. And that's pretty clear just by, you know, people's personal experience going to all different types of people's homes and seeing what they do and don't have. Yet, at the same time, by your own personal experience and examination and by evidence gathered in other places, most people in this society have either a Bible, a Quran, or a Torah. You know, some kind of hocus-pocus book, a sorcery book. So what does that say about an adult population that has sorcery books, witchcraft books, that they base a lot of their lives and principles around, but they don't have books that outline the role of the government within the particular society that they live in. This is how people like Boy George can basically tickle people's chin by preaching out various mystical sounding things about morality and belief in Jesus and Jesus being his best friend and et cetera, et cetera. Meanwhile, at the same time, he is creating a mortal combat against the planet Earth and its natural resources, its living resources, all at the behest, of course, of his particular corporate masters. See, this is how you can see the disconnect that people have when they pummel themselves with this religious dogma. The next, Brenner goes on to explain his feelings on what Jefferson would think of the U.S. Empire in its collusion with some of these hocus-pocus mercenaries that, you know, Sam's
claiming. The United States armed the Islamic fundamentalists in Afghanistan and started arming them in 1979.
Right, to fight the Russians, right?
Right, to fight the Russians, the godless, atheistic communists, okay?
That's right.
Now, understand something. There's no constitutional requirement requiring the government of the United States to act in favor of freedom of religion abroad. It's not in the Constitution, because when the Constitution was set up, the United States, like Jefferson, was the American ambassador to France, when France was a Catholic country with a king and so on, you know, an absolute monarchy and so on and so forth. The United States was too weak to pick and choose, you know, who it would ally with and so on and so forth on the basis of the religion of the country. You understand what I'm getting at, right?
Right.
So it's not a constitutional requirement. However, Jefferson always felt to his dying day that what he was trying to do was generate a revolution in the world, not just in America. Mm-hmm. Now, for example, let me find it here, his last letter, okay? This is Thomas Jefferson to Roger Whiteman. He wrote this on June 24th, 1826. He died on July 4th, no less, 1826, 50 years after the Declaration of Independence. And this is what he had to say about it, all right? This is Jefferson's last words on the Declaration of Independence. May it be to the world what I believe it will be, to some parts sooner, to other parts later, but finally to all, the signal of arousing men to burst the chains under which monkish ignorance and superstition had persuaded them to bind themselves and to assume the blessings and security of self-government. That form which we have substituted restores the free right to the unbounded exercise of reason and freedom of opinion. All eyes are opened or opening to the rights of man. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, here he is talking about the spread of light coming out of the United States to get rid of, burst the chains under which monkish ignorance and superstition had persuaded them to bind themselves. What he means by monkish ignorance is religious ignorance.
Mm.
Okay? He uses monkish whenever he talks about priests and so on, all right? You know,
right.
Listening to them guys with the turned around collars is what we would call it. But he didn't just mean Catholics.
Right.
He meant any kind of priestcraft, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, he got along with individual priests and ministers and so on, you know. I mean, you know, he's always a gentleman. But, you know, as far as he was concerned, who are these guys to tell him what to believe or to tell anybody what to believe, you know? Now, what I'm saying is it's hard to believe that this guy who thought that his declaration was to inspire people to rebel against monkish ignorance, it's hard to believe that he would be arming Islamic fundamentalists in Afghanistan and Israeli Orthodox Jews at the same time. You get my point, all right? In other words, when it comes to outside the bounds of the United States, it's anything goes and the whistle blows, as far as the politicians are concerned, and religion. They were real clever, them fellows, and Democrats and Republicans. They figured they would use Islamic fundamentalism against communism in Afghanistan, just like the German capitalists used Hitler against the communists in Germany, you know?
Yep.
And what they did was, hey, their guy won. You know, Hitler won, and the Islamic fundamentalists won, killed all them commie rats. And then they figured, you know, I'm the Führer. I don't need these German capitalists. What do they know, you know? And similarly, you know, Al-Qaeda came along and said, you know, we took a little dough from these Christian crusaders, you know?
Right.
All right, well, you know, now we're going to dump on the crusaders, man. We beat the Soviet Union.
We can beat the great Satan, too, while we had it.
Yeah, you know, I mean, let's go the whole route.
Well, I don't know if some of these so-called Al-Qaeda guys are really fighting Sam, or, you know, we've been through that type of stuff and manipulation. But what is interesting is that, while it's true that Jefferson and Madison, during their time, would have found it an abomination to aid, you know, particular types of regimes or groups that are so steeped into their mysticism. We're in a different time now, and the corporate state apparatus has empowered itself so much so. You know, back during the day, you know, like George Washington, he actually fought in the war. You know, he physically fought as a general and stuff. Now a president like Boy George, the only thing he's fought is his cocaine habit during the time of, when he was of age to fight some damn war. He ain't fighting no damn war. So, we're in a different type of particular era where, you know, as Jefferson, wrote about how the monkish ignorance, meaning religious ignorance, of course he was against. But in this type of fiercely decadent, dangerously imperial state that the corporate machine finds itself in, monkish ignorance, i.e. religious ignorance amongst the masses, helps the state apparatus maintain and produce its imperial crusade. Because much of the population does not know what else to hang its hat on. It doesn't know or even think about fighting back against the corporate state. Job layoffs are going off like mad. And instead of people filling particular halls, union halls, organizing halls, radical halls, to discuss amongst themselves what the hell to do about these Enrons and Kmarts and so on and so forth. Instead, they're filling themselves into these religious halls, just like the corporate machine wants. Now here, Brenner outlines the debate between the founders on giving poor whites the right to vote. So check this out.
But simply, now here, let me make a criticism of the people of the United States, all right?
Okay.
Madison, in 1787, they were debating whether or not to give poor whites the vote, okay? And they decided to do it on the basis that they already had the vote in some of the states, so that if you didn't give them the federal vote, they would be PO'd, as the saying goes, because they would have it on the state level, but not on the federal level, and they wouldn't trust the federal government. They said, look, if I had my way, I'd keep it to people that owned a little piece of property, at least a little piece of property, because let's face it, what's going to happen in America is the country is going to fill up with poor people. And those people are either going to do one of two things. They're either going to challenge the right of property, or, more likely, wind up the tools of opulent and ambitious men, all right, which would be just as bad. In other words, he was worried that you would get all these ignorant people coming over here from Europe, okay, and they would, the rich would tickle them under the chin and the poor would vote for them.
Right? Right.
Now, that's exactly what happened. Okay? In other words, the country filled up with poor people who came over here largely as religious fanatics.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It isn't until, really until modern times that you're beginning, you always had a few skeptics like Jefferson, right, and Madison. And then in the 19th century, you began to develop a few atheists, okay? I mean, besides the skeptics, just, you know, no God. I don't want to hear about no God. But it's only since Darwin and the rise, particularly in the last part of the 20th century, of mass college education. Okay, I mean, over one out of four Americans now has a college degree.
Okay.
All right? I mean, when I was a kid, I was born in 1937, so the first census after I was born was 1940. At that time, only one out of 20 Americans had a college degree.
Hmm.
All right? And it's now over one out of four. In other words, it's about 26-27% already have a college degree, and millions more are going to college.
And some could be, and of course, it could be argued that maybe some of these degrees are just easier to get.
Well, let me put it this way. Some of them were easier to get in the old days, too. I mean, that may be true. But nevertheless, in the long run, what it means, if you take the statistic as a whole, what it means is that an enormous number of people now can literally go into the library and read whatever they want.
Now, that aspect is true. Unfortunately, what they basically are reading for the most part is a internet porn site 20 hours a day and a sports page the next 4 hours. So it's how you apply yourself. Basically, there has been an ongoing struggle. And one has to say, while these founders realized that the country was going to quote-unquote fill up with poor, they also realized that by the way they set the things up, they were going to have large portions of the population remain poor, because that's part of the economic order, the hierarchical order that was developing and being established and has established itself. So within that context, you are going to, by necessity, want to keep the unwashed masses ignorant of their particular plight from the standpoint of what to do about their plight. You can have them kill themselves, be scared of the black skins and all of that type of stuff. But from developing a class analysis, you want to keep that as far away from them as possible. And the fact that one out of four people now have college degrees and stuff like that, that does not really correlate, if you take like the last 20 or so years, with a raise of economic advantages for those masses. So in other words, more and more people are becoming educated, but it's not showing itself and proving itself on a financial level, on a level where people are having more leisure time. In actuality, just the opposite is happening, because you may have particular types of educational advancement, but as long as those advancements are still in service to a dictatorial hierarchical privatization system, then the machine will continue to crush right over you, degrees and all. But next, let's hear how Brenner outlines the contradictions of an evolving scientific society and a religious-based one. So check this out.
47% of all Americans believe that God created the world within the last 10,000 years. Okay? 57% of all blacks believe that.
Wow.
Okay? Now, when you realize that there's a whole oil industry in the United States that's based on geology and geological ages of millions of years. You understand what I'm saying? In other words, everybody in America uses oil in one way or another. Right. Everybody, all right? I mean, and all that oil is pulled out of the ground because the geologists know where to look, and they know because they have an understanding of how long it takes for certain types of, you know, vegetable matter to decay and turn into tar pits and then into petroleum and so on. You understand that? I mean, because you're an ordinary educated person, all right?
Okay.
But millions of Americans never went to college. Okay? They don't know any of that. All right? And instead of trying to learn something about it, they spend their time, the people that go to church every Sunday and maybe once a week besides to help out on the cooking, you know what I'm talking about, them people?
Yeah.
Okay? That's time that they ain't got their nose in a book. Okay, other than the Bible.
Or the Quran. See, this helps show part of, once again, the contradiction that takes place. When you have an evolving industrialized society like this. Now, actually, we should be into a much developed research into solar power, wind power, etc. In other words, living energy systems. We should be far in advance into that. But since the petroleum-based industrialists want to maintain their particular control, they keep us in the dead energy system, the fossil fuel energy system. But nevertheless, here you have a situation where 47% of the American population overall and 57% of black people in the society believe that the earth was created in the last 10,000 years. Yet at the same time, you need to produce at least a certain percentage of the population that understand that the earth is billions of years old, and that it takes millions of years of certain types of organic material to deteriorate and decompose itself into a product that can be usable like crude oil, and it is your job to go out and find it for these particular industrialists. So here you have the scientific aspect of it that obviously contradicts the hocus-pocus religious aspect of it, yet their job is to keep people mystified and gumpified. So you see how there's always going to be a push, once again, for creationism and for the underdevelopment of the masses of people, because this is not in any way a society that is based on the harmonizing aspect of developing all of its people. Is based in contradictions, is based in exploitation, and one of those ways of exploiting people is through these religions. Now next, Brenner talks about the Treaty of Tripoli that many people don't know about in its details. So check this out.
In 1895, I believe it was, 1795, excuse me, the United States signed a treaty with Tripoli, which was a Muslim city-state in what's now Libya, okay? And they were pirates, so the United States signed a treaty with them. They were constantly capturing ships and, you know, capturing the sailors on them. So the United States signed a treaty with them to arrange that this wouldn't happen with the Americans and so on and so forth. And since this was a Muslim country, they, in the treaty, they said, we're not a Christian state. In other words, you know, like, basically what they were saying is, don't get on our case because we're a Christian state, because we're not an official Christian state.
Okay.
Now, this was, the treaty was signed in Europe, or probably in Algiers, or wherever, under Washington, but it wasn't ratified by the Senate until 1796 under Adams. That's why Adams' name comes in.
Ah.
But it's the only statement, one way or the other, by the founding fathers that the United States was not a Christian country.
So here you have a situation where, because of the situation they found them in, they had signed a treaty in 1795 against the country of Tripoli with the little Islams, saying that they weren't a Christian state, so don't, you know, use that against us and stuff. And it was ratified in 1796 under Adams. And once you ratify something, even like a treaty, it becomes the law of the land. But see, all of this type of stuff is just tossed out, ignored, basically. Now, when someone manipulated the issue of making the corporations a person, which wasn't even really ratified by law, but was just manipulated by some lawyer, this is the doctrine that they follow by because it helps the corporate state apparatus. But when something contradicts that, these lawless barons just ignore it, even though it's supposed to be, quote-unquote, the law of the land. This helps expose the type of class warfare aspect that's really taking place, and that when these clowns talk about law and order and all of that, it's all about order. Order of the machine, laid out by the machine. Now, last we're going to finish up with John Adams' statement about the U.S. Government's development, as Brenner outlined. Check this out.
Who was pretty conservative, I mean very conservative, but I read a statement by him where he says, look, the one thing that's unique about the American government is that those of us who set it up, not one of us claimed that we were in communion with the gods, you know.
So, essentially, what John Adams was saying is that this was not some ordained thing. They didn't pretend that they were the son of, the supernatural being like Jesus or got, you know, the word of the fairy tooth, you know, the fairy tooth man, you know, like Muhammad or whatever the case is, you know. They just basically set up their little state apparatus and da 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 da, but it wasn't by some mystical being. Now, when you hear O'Reilly, Limbaugh, all these right-wing pundits talk about, you know, nation under God and the founding fathers were used the Bible as a guiding post and all of this helps expose that they're manipulating one's ignorance in the same way that they use religion to maintain your ignorance about the real world that we exist in and how politics navigates itself within. That's why I always say religion is political. That's the real world. Now, when you have a situation where, let's take Al Bannon. He was the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood. What does he have in common with the little Zionists of Stern Gang and the little Christians of Adolf Company in Nazi Germany? They all pledged allegiance to Nazism. Al Bannon from the Muslim Brotherhood, him and his gang of Hocus Pocus bandits pledged allegiance to Nazism and Hitler. Stern Gang, the Zionists, pledged allegiance to Adolf and company during the war, during World War II. Yet these are supposed to be the moral creatures. These are state empire builders and or trying to be, with economic hierarchical mindsets in the same way that they have an economic hierarchical view of the world. Certain people are on the bottom, certain people aren't. Some people are worthy to crusading against, to slave. Certain people are not. It's time for us slaves to crucify all of them, because their dogma has no place on our planet anymore. Hold on a sec. wrap it up with Slave tonight. It's clear that as long as those of us continue to believe in this sorcery that these demons put out, will continue to be controlled by the capitalist state apparatus and manipulated on issues of so-called morality. But at the end of the day, all will be in service to is a coffin for the head of state. Until the next time, slaves.